Ranulph was or why the king wanted to see him, but he got the impression that, although Stephen was displeased, he was not serious about mutilating the man. Before Philip could give it any further thought, Walleran stepped forward and bowed, and Henry said, "You remember Walleran Bygod, the new bishop of Kingsbridge?" "Yes," Stephen said, "but who's this?" He looked at Philip. Walleran said, "This is my prior." Walleran did not say his name, so Philip supplied it. "Philip of Gwynedd, prior of Kingsbridge." His voice sounded louder than he had intended. He bowed. "Come forward, Father Prior," Stephen said. "You seem afraid. What are you worried about?" Philip could not think how to answer that. He was worried about so many things. In desperation, he said, "I'm worried because I don't have a clean robe to wear." Stephen laughed, but not unkindly. "Then stop worrying," he said. With a glance at his well-dressed brother, he added, "I like a monk to look like a monk, not like a king." Philip felt a little better. Stephen said, "I heard about the fire. How are you managing?" Philip said, "On the day of the fire, God sent us a builder. He repaired the cloisters very quickly, and we used the crypt for services. With his help, we're clearing the ruins ready for rebuilding, and he has drawn plans for a new church." Walleran raised his eyebrows at that. He did not know about the plans. Philip would have told him if he had asked, but he had not. The king said, "Commendably prompt. When will you begin to build?" "As soon as I can find the money." Bishop Henry cut in. "That's why I've brought Prior Philip and Bishop Walleran to see you. Neither the priory nor the diocese has the resources to finance a project this big."
"Nor does the crown, my dear brother," said Stephen.
Philip was discouraged. That was not a promising beginning. Henry said, "I know. That's why I've looked for a way in which you could make it possible for them to rebuild Kingsbridge, but at no cost to yourself." Stephen looked skeptical. "And did you succeed in devising such an ingenious, not to say magical, scheme?" "Yes. My suggestion is that you should give the Earl of Shiring's lands to the diocese to finance the building program." Philip held his breath. The king looked thoughtful. Walleran opened his mouth to speak, but Henry silenced him with a gesture. The king said, "It's a clever idea. I'd like to do it." Philip's heart leaped. The king said, "Unfortunately, I've just virtually promised the earldom to Percy Hamley." A groan escaped Philip's lips. He had thought the king was going to say yes. The disappointment was like a knife wound. Henry and Walleran were dumbstruck. No one had anticipated this. Henry was the first to speak. He said, "Virtually?" The king shrugged. "I might wriggle out of it, although not without considerable embarrassment. But after all, it was Percy who brought the traitor Bartholomew to justice." Walleran burst out, "Not without help, my lord. I knew you had played some part in it. It was I who told Percy Hamley of the plot against you. Yes, by the way, how did you learn of it?" Philip shuffled his feet. They were on dangerous ground. No one must know that the information had come originally from his brother Francis, for Francis was still working for Robert of Gloucester, who had been forgiven for his part in the plot. Walleran said, "The information came from a deathbed confession." Philip was relieved. Walleran was repeating the lie Philip had told him, but speaking as if the confession had been made to him rather than to Philip. Philip was more than content to have attention drawn away from his own role in this. The king said, "Still, it was Percy, not you, who attacked Bartholomew's castle, risking life and limb, and arrested the traitor. You could reward Percy some other way," Henry put in. "Shiring is what Percy wants," the king said. "He knows the area, and he'll rule effectively there. I could give him Cambridgeshire, but would the fenmen follow him?" Henry said,
You ought to give thanks to God first, men second. It was God who made you king. But it was Percy who arrested Bartholomew. Henry bridled at this irreverence. God controls all things. Don't press me on this, Stephen said, holding up his right hand. Of course, Henry said submissively. It was a vivid demonstration of royal power. For a moment there they had been arguing almost like equals, but Stephen had been able to regain the upper hand with a word. Philip was bitterly disappointed. At the start, he had thought this an impossible demand, but he had gradually come to hope it would be granted, even to fantasize about how he would use the wealth. Now he had been brought back to reality with a hard bump. Walleran said, My lord king, I thank you for being willing to reconsider the future of the Shiring earldom, and I will await your decision anxiously and prayerfully. That was neat, Philip thought. It sounded as if Walleran was giving in gracefully. In fact, he was summing up by saying that the question was still open. The king had not said that. If anything, his response had been negative. But there was nothing offensive about insisting that the king could still decide one way or the other. I must remember that, Philip thought. When you're about to be turned down, go for a postponement. Stephen hesitated a moment, as if entertaining a faint suspicion that he was being manipulated. Then he seemed to dismiss any doubts. Thank you all for coming to see me, he said. Philip and Walleran turned to leave, but Henry stood his ground and said, When shall we hear your decision? Stephen once again looked somewhat cornered. The day after tomorrow, he said. Henry bowed, and the three of them went out. The uncertainty was almost as bad as a negative decision. Philip found the waiting unbearable. He spent the afternoon with the Winchester Priory's marvellous collection of books, but they could not distract him from wondering what was going on in the king's mind. Could the king renege on his promise to Percy Hamley? How important was Percy? He was a member of the gentry who aspired to an earldom. Surely Stephen had no reason to fear offending him. But how badly did Stephen want to help Kingsbridge? Notoriously, kings became pious as they aged. Stephen was young. Philip was turning the possibilities over and over in his mind, and looking at, but not reading, Boethius's The Consolation of Philosophy, when a novice came tiptoeing along the cloister walk and approached him shyly. "There's someone asking for you in the outer court, father," the lad whispered. If the visitor had been made to wait outside, that meant he was not a monk. "Who is it?" Philip said. "It's a woman." Philip's first horrified thought was that it was the whore who had accosted him outside the mint, but something in the novice's expression told him otherwise. There was another woman whose eyes had met his today. What does she look like? The boy made a disgusted face. Philip nodded, understanding. Regan Hamley. What mischief was she up to now? I'll come at once. He walked slowly and thoughtfully around the cloisters and out to the courtyard. He would need his wits about him to deal with this woman. She was standing outside the cellarer's parlour, wrapped in a heavy cloak, hiding her face in a hood. She gave Philip a look of such naked malevolence that he had half a mind to turn around and go back in immediately, but he was ashamed to run from a woman, so he stood his ground and said, "What do you want with me?"
"You foolish monk," she spat. "How can you be so stupid?"
He felt his face redden. "I'm the prior of Kingsbridge, and you'd better call me father," he said, but to his chagrin he sounded petulant rather than authoritative.
"All right, father. How can you just let yourself be used by those two greedy bishops?"
Philip took a deep breath.
"Speak plainly," he said angrily.
"It's hard to find words plain enough for someone as witless as you, but I'll try. Walleran is using the burned-down church as a pretext for getting the lands of the Shiring earldom for himself. Is that plain speaking? Have you grasped that concept?" Her contemptuous tone continued to rile Philip,
but he could not resist the temptation to defend himself. "There's nothing underhand about it," he said. "The income from the lands is to be used to rebuild the cathedral."
"What makes you think so?"
"That's the whole idea," Philip protested, but at the back of his mind he already felt the first stirrings of doubt. Regan's scornful tone changed, and she became sly.
"Will the new lands belong to the priory?" she said, "or to the diocese?"
Philip stared at her for a moment, then turned away. Her face was too revolting to look at. He had been working on the assumption that the lands would belong to the priory and be under his control, rather than to the diocese, where they would be under Walleran's control. But he now recalled that when they had been with the king, Bishop Henry had specifically asked for the lands to be given to the diocese. Philip had assumed that was a slip of the tongue, but it had not been corrected, then or later. He eyed Regan suspiciously. She could not possibly have known what Henry was going to say to the king. She might be right about this. On the other hand, she could simply be trying to make trouble. She had everything to gain from a quarrel between Philip and Walleran at this point. Philip said, "Walleran is the bishop. He has to have a cathedral."
"He has to have a lot of things," she rejoined.
She became less malevolent and more human as she began to reason, but Philip still could not bear to look at her for long.
"For some bishops, a fine cathedral would be the first priority. For Walleran, there are other necessities.
Anyway, as long as he controls the purse strings, he will be able to dole out as much, or as little, as he likes to you and your builders." Philip realized she was right about that, at least. If Walleran was collecting the rents, he would naturally retain a portion for his expenses. He alone would be able to say what that portion should be. There would be nothing to stop him from diverting the funds to purposes having nothing to do with the cathedral, if he so chose. And Philip would never know from one month to the next whether he was going to be able to pay the builders. There was no doubt it would be better if the priory owned the land. But Philip was sure Walleran would resist that idea, and Bishop Henry would back Walleran. Then Philip's only hope would be to appeal to the king, and King Stephen, seeing the churchmen divided, might solve the problem by giving the earldom to Percy Hanley, which was what Regan wanted, of course. Philip shook his head. "If Walleran is trying to deceive me, why did he bring me here at all? He could have come on his own and made the same plea." She nodded.
"He could have. But the king might have asked himself how sincere Walleran was, saying that he only wanted the earldom in order to build the cathedral. You've lulled any suspicions Stephen might have had by appearing here in support of Walleran's claim."
Her tone became contemptuous again.
"And you look so pathetic in your dirty robe that the king pities you. No, Walleran was clever to bring you."
Philip had a horrible feeling she might be right, but he was not willing to admit it. "You just want the earldom for your husband," he said.
"If I could show you proof, would you ride half a day to see it?"
The last thing Philip wanted was to be sucked into Regan Hamley's scheming, but he had to find out whether her allegation was true. Reluctantly he said,
"Yes, I'll ride half a day."
"Tomorrow?"
"Yes. Be ready at dawn."
It was William Hamley, the son of Percy and Regan, who was waiting for Philip in the outer courtyard the following morning, as the monks began to sing prime. Philip and William left Winchester by the west gate, then immediately turned north on Atheling Street. Bishop Walleran's palace was in this direction, Philip realized, and it was about half a day's ride. So that was where they were going. But why? He was deeply suspicious. He decided to be alert for trickery. The Hamleys might well be trying to use him. He speculated about how. There might be a document in Walleran's possession that the Hamleys wanted to see or even steal, some kind of deed or charter. Young Lord William could tell the bishop's staff that the two of them had been sent to fetch the document. They might believe him because Philip was with him. William could easily have some such little scheme up his sleeve. Philip would have to be on his guard. It was a gloomy grey morning with drizzling rain. William set a brisk pace for the first few miles, then slowed to a walk to rest the horses. After a while he said, "So, monk, you want to take the earldom away from me?" Philip was taken aback by his hostile tone. He had done nothing to deserve it, and he resented it. Consequently, his reply was sharp. "From you?" he said. "You aren't going to get it, boy. I might get it, or your father might, or Bishop Walleran might. But nobody has asked the king to give it to you. The very idea is a joke." "I shall inherit it. We'll see." Philip decided there was no point in quarrelling with William. "I don't mean you any harm," he said in a conciliatory tone. "I just want to build a new cathedral." "Then take someone else's earldom," William said. "Why do people always pick on us?" There was a lot of bitterness in the boy's voice, Philip noted. He said, "Do people always pick on you? You'd think they'd learn a lesson from what happened to Bartholomew. He insulted our family, and look where he is now. I thought it was his daughter who was responsible for the insult. The bitch is as proud and arrogant as her father, but she'll suffer too. They'll all kneel to us in the end, you'll see." These were not the usual emotions of a 20-year-old, Philip thought. William sounded more like an envious and venomous middle-aged woman. Philip was not enjoying the conversation. Most people would dress up their naked hatred in reasonable clothes, but William was too naive to do that. Philip said, "Revenge is best left until the day of judgment." "Why don't you wait until the day of judgment to build your church?"
"Because by then it will be too late to save the souls of sinners from the torments of hell."
"Don't start on about that," William said,
and there was a note of hysteria in his voice.
"Save it for your sermons."
Philip was tempted to make another sharp retort, but he bit it back. There was something very odd about this boy. Philip had the feeling that William could fly into an uncontrollable rage at any moment, and that when enraged he would be lethally violent. Philip was not afraid of him. He had no fear of violent men, perhaps because, as a child, he had seen the worst they could do and survived it. But there was nothing to be gained by infuriating William with reprimands, so he said gently, "Heaven and hell is what I deal in. Virtue and sin, forgiveness and punishment, good and evil. I'm afraid I can't shut up about them."
"Then talk to yourself," William said, and he spurred his horse into a trot and pulled ahead.
When he was 40 or 50 yards in front, he slowed down again. Philip wondered whether the boy would relent and return to ride side by side. But he did not, and for the rest of the morning they travelled apart. Philip felt anxious and somewhat depressed. He had lost control of his destiny. He had let Walleran by God take charge in Winchester, and now he was letting William Hamley take him on a mystery journey. "They're all trying to manipulate me," he thought. "Why am I letting them? It's time I started to take the initiative." But there was nothing he could do right away, except turn around and go back to Winchester, and that seemed like a futile gesture. So he continued to follow William, staring gloomily at William's horse's rear end as they jogged along. A little before noon they reached the valley where the bishop's palace was. Philip recalled coming here at the beginning of the year, full of trepidation, bringing with him a deadly secret. An awful lot had changed since then. To his surprise, William rode past the palace and on up the hill. The road narrowed to a simple path between fields. It led nowhere important, Philip knew. As they approached the top of the hill, Philip saw that some kind of building work was going on. A little below the summit, they were stopped by a bank of earth that looked as if it had been dug up recently. Philip was struck by an awful suspicion. They turned aside and rode alongside the bank until they found a gap. They went through. Inside the bank was a dry moat, filled in at this point, to allow people to cross. Philip said, "Is this what we came to see?" William just nodded. Philip's suspicion was confirmed. Walleran was building a castle. He was devastated. He kicked his horse forward and crossed the ditch, with William following. The ditch and the bank encircled the top of the hill. On the inside rim of the ditch a thick stone wall had been built to a height of 2 or 3 feet. The wall was clearly unfinished, and judging by its thickness, it was intended to be very high. Walleran was building a castle, but there were no workmen on the site, no tools to be seen, and no stacks of stone or timber. A great deal had been done in a short time, then work had stopped suddenly. Obviously, Walleran had run out of money. Philip said to William, "I suppose there's no doubt that it is the bishop who is building this castle." William said, "Would Walleran, by God, allow anyone else to build a castle next to his palace?" Philip felt hurt and humiliated. The picture was crystal clear. Bishop Walleran wanted the Shiring earldom, with its quarry and its timber, to build his own castle, not the cathedral. Philip was merely a tool, the burning of Kingsbridge Cathedral just a convenient excuse. Their role was to enliven the king's piety so that he would grant Walleran the earldom. Philip saw himself as Walleran and Henry must see him, naive, compliant, smiling and nodding as he was led to the slaughter. They had judged him so well. He had trusted them and deferred to them. He had even borne their slights with a brave smile, because he thought they were helping him when all the time they were double-crossing him. He was shocked by Walleran's unscrupulousness. He recalled the look of sadness in Walleran's eyes as he looked at the ruined cathedral. Philip had glimpsed the deep-rooted piety in Walleran at that moment. Walleran must think that pious ends justified dishonest means in the service of the church. Philip had never believed that. "I would never do to Walleran what Walleran is trying to do to me," he thought. He had never before thought of himself as gullible. He wondered where he had gone wrong. It occurred to him that he had let himself be overawed by Bishop Henry and his silk robes, by the magnificence of Winchester and its cathedral, by the piles of silver in the mint and the heaps of meat in the butcher's shops, and by the thought of seeing the king. He had forgotten that God saw through the silk robes to the sinful heart, that the only wealth worth having was treasure in heaven, and that even the king had to kneel down in church. Feeling that everyone else was so much more powerful and sophisticated than he was, he had lost sight of his true values, suspended his critical faculties, and placed his trust in his superiors. His reward had been treachery. He took one more look around the rain-swept building site, then turned his horse and rode away, feeling wounded. William followed.
"What about that, then, monk?"
William jeered. Philip did not reply. He recalled that he had helped Walleran become bishop. Walleran had said, "You want me to make you prior of Kingsbridge. I want you to make me bishop." Of course, Walleran had not revealed that the bishop was already dead, so the promise had seemed somewhat insubstantial, and it had seemed that Philip was obliged to give the promise in order to secure his election as prior. But these were just excuses. The truth was that he should have left the choice of prior and bishop in the hands of God. He had not made that pious decision, and his punishment was that he had to contend with Bishop Walleran. When he thought about how he had been slighted, condescended to, manipulated, and deceived, he became angry. Obedience was a monastic virtue, but outside the cloisters it had its drawbacks, he thought bitterly. The world of power and property required that a man be suspicious, demanding, and insistent. "Those lying bishops made a fool of you, didn't they?" William said. Philip reined in his horse. Shaking with rage, he pointed a finger at William.
"Shut your mouth, boy. You're speaking of God's holy priests. If you say another word, you'll burn for it, I promise you."
William went white with fear. Philip kicked his horse on. William's sneer reminded him that the Hamleys had an ulterior motive in taking him to see Walleran's castle. They wanted to cause a quarrel between Philip and Walleran, to ensure that the disputed earldom would go to neither the prior nor the bishop, but to Percy. Well, Philip was not going to be manipulated by them either. He had finished being manipulated. From now on, he would do the manipulating. That was all very well, but what could be done? If Philip quarrelled with Walleran, Percy would get the lands, and if Philip did nothing, Walleran would get them. What did the king want? He wanted to help build the new cathedral. That kind of thing was appropriately kingly and would benefit his soul in the afterlife. but he needed to reward Percy's loyalty, too. Oddly enough, there was no particular pressure on him to please the more powerful men, the two bishops. It occurred to Philip that there might be a solution to the dilemma that would solve the king's problem by satisfying both himself and Percy Hamley. Now there was a thought. The idea pleased him. An alliance between himself and the Hamleys was the last thing anyone expected, and for that reason it just might work. The bishops would be completely unprepared for it. They would be caught wrong-footed. That would be a delightful reversal. But could he negotiate a deal with the grasping Hamleys? Percy wanted the rich farmland of Shiring, the title of Earl, and the power and prestige of a force of knights under his command. Philip, too, wanted the rich farmland, but he did not want the title or the knights. He was more interested in the quarry and the forest. The form of a compromise began to take shape in Philip's mind. He began to think that all was not yet lost. How sweet it would be to win now, after all that had happened. With mounting excitement, he considered his approach to the Hamleys. He was determined he would not play the role of supplicant. He would have to make his proposal seem irresistible. By the time they reached Winchester, Philip's cloak was soaked through and his horse was bad-tempered, but he thought he had the answer. As they passed under the arch of the West Gate, he said to William, "Let's go and see your mother." William was surprised. "I thought you would want to see Bishop Walleran right away." No doubt that was what Regan had told William to expect. "Don't bother to tell me what you thought, lad," Philip snapped. "Just take me to your mother." He felt very ready for a confrontation with Lady Regan. He had been passive too long. William turned south and led Philip to a house in Gold Street, between the castle and the cathedral. It was a large dwelling with stone walls to waist level and a timber frame above. Inside was an entrance hall with several apartments off it. The Hamleys were probably lodging here. Many Winchester citizens rented rooms to people who were attending the royal court. If Percy became Earl, he would have his own townhouse. William showed Philip into a front room with a big bed in it and a fireplace. Regan was sitting by the fire and Percy was standing near her. Regan looked up at Philip with an expression of surprise, but she recovered quickly enough and said, "Well, monk, was I right?" "You were as wrong as you could be, you foolish woman," Philip said harshly. She was shocked into silence by his angry tone. He was gratified by the effect of giving her a taste of her own medicine. He went on in the same tone. "You thought you could cause a quarrel between me and Walleran. Did you imagine I wouldn't see what you were up to? You're a sly vixen, but you're not the only person in the world who can think." He could see by her face that she realized her plan had not worked, and she was thinking furiously what to do next. He pressed on while she was disconcerted. "You've failed, Regan. You've got two options now. One is to sit tight and hope for the best. Wait for the king's decision. Take your chances on his mood tomorrow morning." He paused. She spoke reluctantly. "And the alternative?" "The alternative is that we make a deal, you and I. We divide the earldom between us, leaving nothing for Walleran. We go to the king privately and tell him we've reached a compromise, and get his blessing for it before the bishops can object." Philip sat down on a bench and pretended a casual air. "It's your best chance. You've got no real choice." He looked into the fire, not wanting her to see how tense he was. The idea had to appeal to them, he thought. It was the certainty of getting something weighed against the possibility of getting nothing. But they were greedy. They might prefer an all-or-nothing gamble. It was Percy who spoke first. "Divide the earldom? How?" They were interested, at least, Philip thought with relief. "I'm going to propose a division so generous that you would be mad to turn it down," Philip said to him. He turned back to Regan. "I'm offering you the best half." They looked at him, waiting for him to elaborate, but he said no more. Regan said, "What do you mean, the best half? What is more valuable, arable land or forest?" "Arable land, certainly." "Then you shall have the arable, and I'll have the forest." Regan narrowed her eyes.
That will give you timber for your cathedral.
Correct.
What about pasture?
Which do you want, the cattle pastures or the sheep grazing?
The pasture.
Then I'll have the hill farms with their sheep. Would you like the income from markets or the quarry?
Percy said, the market, Inc.
Regan interrupted him.
Suppose we said the quarry.
Philip knew she had understood what was on his mind. He wanted the stone from the quarry for his cathedral. He knew she did not want the quarry. The markets made more money for less effort. He said confidently,
You won't, though, will you?
She shook her head. No, we'll take the markets. Percy tried to look as if he were being fleeced.
I need the forest to hunt, he said. An earl must have some hunting.
You can hunt there, Philip said quickly. I just want the timber.
That's agreeable, Regan said.
Her agreement came a little too quickly for Philip's comfort. He felt a pang of anxiety. Had he given something important away without knowing it? Or was she simply impatient to dispose of a trifling detail? Before he could give it much thought, she went on,
Suppose we go through the deeds and charters in Earl Bartholomew's old treasury, and find there are some lands that we think should be ours, and you think should be yours.
The fact that she was getting down to such details encouraged Philip to think she was going to accept his proposal. He concealed his excitement and spoke coolly.
We'll have to agree on an arbitrator.
How about Bishop Henry?
A priest, she said with a touch of her habitual scorn. Would he be objective?
No.
How about the Sheriff of Shiring?
He would be no more objective than the bishop, Philip thought, but he could not think of anyone who would satisfy both sides, so he said,
Agreed.
On condition that if we dispute his decision, we have the right to appeal to the king. That ought to be a sufficient safeguard.
Agreed, Regan said.
Then she glanced at Percy and added,
If my husband pleases.
Percy said, Yes, yes. Philip knew he was close to success. He took a deep breath and said, If the overall proposal is agreed, then...
Wait a moment. Regan stopped him. It's not agreed.
But I've given you everything you want.
We might yet get the whole earldom. No division.
And you might get nothing at all.
Regan hesitated. How do you propose to handle this, if we do agree?
Philip had thought of that. He looked at Percy. Could you get to see the king tonight? Percy looked anxious, but he said,
If I had a good reason, yes.
Go to him and tell him we've reached an agreement. Ask him to announce it as his decision tomorrow morning. Assure him that you and I will declare ourselves satisfied with it.
What if he asks whether the bishops have agreed to it?
Say there hasn't been time to put it to them. Remind him that it is the prior, not the bishop, who has to build the cathedral. Imply that if I am satisfied... The bishops must be too.
But what if the bishops complain when the deal is announced?
How can they? Philip said. They're pretending to ask for the earldom solely in order to finance the cathedral. Walleran can hardly protest on the grounds that he will now be unable to divert funds to other purposes.
Regan gave a short cackle.
Philip's cunning appealed to her.
It's a good plan, she said.
There's an important condition. Philip said, and he looked her in the eye. The king must announce that my share goes to the priory. If he doesn't make that clear, I'll ask him to. If he says anything else, the diocese, the sacrist, the archbishop, anything, I'll repudiate the whole deal. I don't want you to be in any doubt about that.
I understand, said Regan, a little tetchily.
Her irritation made Philip suspect that she had been toying with the idea of presenting to the king a slightly different version of the agreement. He was glad he had made the point firmly. He got up to leave, but he wanted to set the seal on their pact somehow. "We are agreed, then," he said, with just the hint of a question in his voice. "We have a solemn pact." He looked at them both. Regan gave a slight nod, and Percy said, "We have a pact." Philip's heart beat faster.
Good, he said tightly. I'll see you tomorrow morning at the castle.
He kept his face expressionless as he left the room,
but when he reached the dark street he relaxed his control and permitted himself a broad, triumphant grin. Philip fell into a troubled, anxious sleep after supper. He got up at midnight for matins, then lay awake on his straw mattress, wondering what would happen tomorrow. He felt King Stephen ought to consent to the proposal. It solved the king's problem. It gave him an earl and a cathedral. He was not so sure that Walleran would take it lying down, despite what he had said to Lady Regan. Walleran might find an excuse to object to the arrangement. He might, if he thought fast enough, protest that the deal did not provide the money to build the impressive, prestigious, richly decorated cathedral he wanted. The king might be persuaded to think again. A different hazard occurred to Philip shortly before dawn. Regan might double-cross him. She could do a deal with Walleran. Suppose she offered the bishop the same compromise. Walleran would have the stone and timber he needed for his castle. This possibility agitated Philip, and he turned restlessly in his bed. He wished he could have gone to the king himself, but the king probably would not have received him. And anyway, Walleran might have learned of it and become suspicious. No, there was no action he could have taken to guard against the risk of a double cross. All he could do now was pray. He did that until dawn. He took breakfast with the monks. He found that their white bread did not keep the stomach full as long as horse bread, but even so he could not eat much of it today. He went early to the castle, although he knew the king would not be receiving people at that hour. He entered the hall and sat on one of the stone wall seats to wait. The room slowly filled up with petitioners and courtiers. Some of them were very brightly dressed, with yellow and blue and pink tunics and lush fur trimmings on their cloaks. The famous Doomsday Book was kept somewhere in this castle, Philip recalled. It was probably in the hall above, where the king had received Philip and the two bishops. Philip had not noticed it, but he had been too tense to notice much. The royal treasury was here, too, but that was presumably on the top floor, in a vault off the king's bedroom. Once again Philip found himself somewhat awestruck by his surroundings, but he had resolved not to be intimidated any longer. These people in their fine robes, knights and lords and merchants and bishops, were just men. Most of them could not write much more than their own names. Furthermore, they were all here to get something for themselves, but he, Philip, was here on behalf of God. His mission and his dirty brown robe put him above the other petitioners, not below them. That thought gave him courage. A ripple of tension ran through the room as a priest appeared on the stairs leading to the upper hall. Everyone hoped that meant the king was receiving. The priest exchanged a few murmured words with one of the armed guards, then disappeared back up the stairs. The guard picked out a knight from the crowd. The knight left his sword with the guards and went up the stairs. Philip thought, what an odd life the king's clergyman must lead. The king had to have clergy, of course, not just to say mass, but to do the vast amount of reading and writing involved in governing the kingdom. There was nobody else to do it other than clergy. Those few laymen who were literate could not read or write fast enough. But there was nothing very holy about the life of the king's clergy. Philip's own brother Francis had chosen that life, and worked for Robert of Gloucester. I must ask him what it's like, Philip thought, if I ever see him again. Soon after the first petitioner went up the stairs, the Hamleys came in. Philip resisted the impulse to go to them straight away. He did not want the world to know they were in collusion, not yet. He stared at them intently, studying their expressions, trying to read their thoughts. He decided that William looked hopeful, Percy seemed anxious, and Regan was as taut as a bowstring. After a few moments, Philip stood up and crossed the room as casually as he could manage. He greeted them politely, then said to Percy, "Did you see him?" "Yes." "And?" "He said he would think about it overnight." "But why?" Philip said. He was disappointed and cross. "What is there to think about?" Percy shrugged. "Ask him." Philip was exasperated. "Well, how did he seem? Pleased or what?" Regan answered, "My guess is that he liked the idea of being released from his dilemma, but felt suspicious that it all sounded too easy." That made sense, but Philip was still annoyed that King Stephen had not seized the opportunity with both hands.
"We'd better not talk any longer," he said after a moment. "We don't want the bishops to guess that we're colluding against them, not before the king makes his announcement."
He nodded politely and moved away. He returned to his stone seat. He tried to pass the time by thinking about what he would do if his plan worked. How soon could work start on the new cathedral? It depended on how quickly he could get some cash out of his new property. There would be quite a lot of sheep. He would have fleeces to sell in the summer. Some of the hill farms would be rented, and most rents fell due soon after harvest time. By the autumn there might be enough money to hire a forester and a master quarryman and begin stockpiling timber and stone. At the same time, labourers could start to dig the foundations under the supervision of Tom Builder. They might be ready to start stonework sometime next year. It was a fine dream. Courtiers went up and down the stairs with alarming rapidity. King Stephen was working fast today. Philip began to worry that the king might finish his day's work and go hunting before the bishops arrived. At last they came. Philip got to his feet slowly as they walked in. Walleran looked tense, but Henry just looked bored. To Henry this was a minor matter. He owed support to his fellow bishop, but the outcome would make little difference to him. For Walleran, however, the outcome was crucial to his plan to build a castle, and a castle was only a step in Walleran's upward progress on the ladder of power. Philip was not sure how to treat them. They had tried to trick him, and he wanted to rail at them, to tell them that he had discovered their treachery. But that would alert them that something was up, and he wanted them all unsuspecting, so that the compromise would be endorsed by the king before they could gather their wits. So he concealed his feelings and smiled politely. He need not have bothered. They ignored him completely. It was not long before the guards called them. Henry and Walleran went up the stairs first, followed by Philip. The Hamleys brought up the rear. Philip's heart was in his mouth. King Stephen was standing in front of the fire. Today he seemed to have a more brisk and businesslike air. That was good. He would be impatient of any quibbling by the bishops. Bishop Henry went and stood beside his brother at the fire, and the others all stood in a line in the middle of the room. Philip felt a pain in his hands, and realized he was pressing his fingernails into his palms. He forced his fingers to relax. The king spoke to Bishop Henry in a low voice that no one else could hear. Henry frowned and said something equally inaudible. They talked for a few moments, then Stephen held up a hand to silence his brother. He looked at Philip. Philip reminded himself that the king had spoken kindly to him last time, joshing him about being nervous and saying he liked a monk to dress like a monk. There were no pleasantries today, however. The king coughed and began, "My loyal subject Percy Hamley today becomes the Earl of Shiring." From the corner of his eye, Philip saw Walleran start forward as if to protest, but Bishop Henry stopped him with a quick, forbidding gesture. The king went on, "Of the former earl's possessions, Percy shall have the castle, all the land that is tenanted to knights, plus all other arable land and low-lying pasture." Philip could hardly contain his excitement. It looked as if the king had accepted the deal. He stole another look at Walleran, whose face was a picture of frustration. Percy knelt in front of the king and held his hands together in an attitude of prayer. The king placed his hands over Percy's. "I make you, Percy, Earl of Shiring, to have and enjoy the lands and revenues aforesaid." Percy said, "I swear by all that is holy to be your liegeman and to fight for you against any other." Stephen released Percy's hands, and Percy stood up. Stephen turned to the rest of them. "All other farmlands belonging to the former earl, I give—" He paused for a moment, looking from Philip to Walleran and back again. "I give to the Priory of Kingsbridge for the building of the new cathedral." Philip suppressed a whoop of joy. He had won. He could not stop himself from beaming with pleasure at the king. He looked at Walleran. Walleran was shocked to the core. He was making no pretense of equanimity. His mouth was open, his eyes were wide, and he was staring at the king with frank incredulity. His gaze swiveled to Philip. Walleran knew he had failed somehow, and that Philip was the beneficiary of his failure. But he could not imagine how it had happened. King Stephen said, "Kingsbridge Priory shall also have the right to take stone from the Earl's quarry and timber from his forest, without limit, for the building of the new cathedral." Philip's throat went dry. That was not the deal. The quarry and the forest were supposed to belong to the priory, and Percy was only to have hunting rights. Regan had altered the terms after all. Now Percy was to own the property, and the priory merely had the right to take timber and stone. Philip had only a few seconds to decide whether to repudiate the whole deal. The king was saying, "In the event of a disagreement, the sheriff of Shiring shall adjudicate, but the parties have the right to appeal to me as a last resort." Philip was thinking, "Regan has behaved outrageously, but what difference does it make? The deal still gives me most of what I wanted." Then the king said, "I believe this arrangement had already been approved by both sides here," and there was no time left. Percy said, "Yes, Lord King." Walleran opened his mouth to deny that he had approved the compromise, but Philip got in first. "Yes, Lord King," he said. Bishop Henry and Bishop Walleran both turned their heads to Philip and stared at him. Their expressions showed utter astonishment as they realized that Philip, the youthful prior who did not even know enough to wear a clean habit to the king's court, had negotiated a deal with the king behind their backs. After a moment, Henry's face relaxed into amusement, like one who is beaten at nine men's morris by a nimble-witted child. But Walleran's gaze became malevolent. Philip felt he could read Walleran's mind. Walleran was realizing that he had made the cardinal error of underestimating his opponent, and he was humiliated. For Philip, this moment made up for everything. The treachery, the humiliation, the slights. Philip lifted his chin, risking committing the sin of pride, and gave Walleran a look that said, "You'll have to try harder than that to outwit Philip of Gwynedd." The king said, "Let the former Earl, Bartholomew, be told of my decision." Bartholomew was in a dungeon somewhere nearby, Philip presumed. He remembered those children living with their servant in the ruined castle, and he felt a pang of guilt as he wondered what would happen to them now. The king dismissed everyone except Bishop Henry. Philip crossed the room, floating on air. He reached the top of the staircase at the same time as Walleran, and stopped to let Walleran go first. Walleran shot him a look of poisonous fury. When he spoke, his voice was like bile, and despite Philip's elation, Walleran's words chilled him to the bone. The mask of hatred opened its mouth, and Walleran hissed, "I swear by all that's holy, you'll never build your church." Then he pulled his black robes around his shoulders and went down the stairs. Philip realized he had made an enemy for life. 3. William Hamley could hardly contain his excitement when Earl's Castle came into sight. It was the afternoon of the day after the king had made his decision. William and Walter had ridden for most of 2 days, but William did not feel tired. He felt as if his heart was swelling up in his chest and blocking his throat. He was about to see Aliena again. He had once hoped to marry her because she was the daughter of an earl, and she had rejected him 3 times. He winced as he remembered her scorn. She had made him feel like a nobody, a peasant. She had acted as if the Hamleys were a family of no account. But the tables had turned. It was her family that was of no account now. He was the son of an earl, and she was nothing. She had no title, no position, no land, no wealth. He was going to take possession of the castle, and he was going to throw her out. And then she would have no home either. It was almost too good to be true. He slowed his horse as they approached the castle. He did not want Aliena to have any warning of his arrival. He wanted her to have a sudden, horrible, devastating shock. Earl Percy and Countess Regan had returned to their old manor house at Hamley to arrange for the treasure, the best horses, and the household servants to be moved to the castle. William's job was to hire some local people to clean up the castle, light fires, and make the place habitable. Low iron-grey clouds boiled across the sky, so close they seemed almost to touch the battlements. There would be rain tonight. That made it even better. He would be throwing Aliena out into a storm. He and Walter dismounted and walked their horses over the wooden drawbridge. "Last time I was here, I captured the place," William thought proudly. The grass was already growing in the lower compound. They tied up their horses and left them to graze. William gave his war horse a handful of grain. They stowed their saddles in the stone chapel, as there was no stable. The horses snorted and stamped, but a wind was blowing up and the sounds were lost. William and Walter crossed the second bridge to the upper compound. There was no sign of life. William suddenly thought that Aliena might have gone. What a disappointment that would be. He and Walter would have to spend a dreary, hungry night in a cold and dirty castle. They went up the outside steps to the hall door. "Quietly," William said to Walter, "if they're here, I want to give them a shock." He pushed open the door. The great hall was empty and dark and smelled as if it had not been used for months. As he had expected, they had been living on the top floor. William trod softly as he walked across the hall to the stairs. Dry reeds rustled under his feet. Walter followed close behind. They climbed the stairs. They could hear nothing. The thick stone walls of the keep muffled all sound. Halfway up, William stopped, turned to Walter, put his finger to his lips and pointed. There was a light shining under the door at the top of the stairs. Someone was here. They went on up the stairs and paused outside the door. From inside came the sound of a girlish laugh. William smiled happily. He found the handle, turned it gently, then kicked the door open. The laugh turned into a scream of fright. The scene in the room made a pretty picture. Aliena and her younger brother, Richard, were sitting at a small table, close to the fire, playing a board game of some kind, and Matthew, the steward, was standing behind her, looking over her shoulder. Aliena's face was rose-colored in the glow of the fire, and her dark curls glinted with auburn lights. She wore a pale linen tunic. She was looking up at William with her red lips in a big O of surprise. William watched her, enjoying her fright, saying nothing. After a moment she recovered, stood up, and said, "What do you want?" William had rehearsed this scene many times in his imagination. He walked slowly into the room and stood by the fire, warming his hands. Then he said, "I live here. What do you want?" Aliena looked from him to Walter. She was scared and confused, but nevertheless her tone was challenging. "This castle belongs to the Earl of Shiring. State your business, and then clear out." William smiled triumphantly. "The Earl of Shiring is my father," he said. The steward grunted, as if he had been afraid of this. Aliena looked bewildered. William went on, "The king made my father Earl yesterday, at Winchester. The castle now belongs to us. I'm the master here, until my father arrives." He snapped his fingers at the steward. "And I'm hungry, so bring me bread and meat and wine." The steward hesitated. He threw a worried look at Aliena. He was afraid to leave her, but he had no choice. He went to the door. Aliena took a step toward the door as if to follow him. "Stay here," William ordered her. Walter stood between her and the door, barring her way. "You have no right to command me," Aliena said with a touch of her old imperiousness. Matthew spoke in a scared tone. "Stay, my lady. Don't anger them. I'll be quick." Aliena frowned at him, but she stayed where she was. Matthew went out. William sat in Aliena's chair. She moved to her brother's side. William studied them. There was a similarity between them, but all the strength was in the girl's face. Richard was a tall, awkward adolescent with no beard yet. William liked the sensation of having them in his power. He said, "How old are you, Richard?" 14 years. The boy said sullenly. "Ever killed a man?" "No," he answered. Then, with a little attempt at bravado, he added, "Not yet." "You'll suffer too, you pompous little prick," William thought. He turned his attention to Aliena. "How old are you?" At first she looked as if she would not speak to him, but then she appeared to change her mind. perhaps remembering that Matthew had said, "Don't anger them." 17, she said.
"My, my, the whole family can count," William said.
"Are you a virgin, Aliena?"
"Of course," she blazed. Suddenly William reached forward and grabbed her breast. It filled his big hand. He squeezed. It felt firm but yielding. She jerked back and it slipped from his grasp. Richard stepped forward, too late, and knocked William's arm aside. Nothing could have pleased William more. He came out of his chair fast and hit Richard in the face with a swinging punch. As he had suspected, Richard was soft. He cried out and his hands flew to his face.
"Leave him alone!" Aliena cried.
William looked at her with surprise. She seemed more concerned about her brother than about herself. That might be worth remembering. Matthew came back in carrying a wooden platter with a loaf of bread, a side of ham, and a jug of wine on it. He paled when he saw Richard holding his hands to his face. He put the platter down on the table and went to the boy. Taking Richard's hands away gently, he looked at the boy's face. It was already red and puffy around the eye.
"I told you not to anger them," he muttered,
but he seemed relieved that it was no worse. William was disappointed. He had hoped Matthew would fly into a rage. The steward threatened to be a killjoy. The sight of the food made William's mouth water. He pulled his chair up to the table, took out his eating knife, and cut a thick slice of ham. Walter sat opposite him. Through a mouthful of bread and ham, William said to Aliena, "Bring some cups and pour the wine." Matthew moved to do it. William said,
"Not you."
"Her." Aliena hesitated. Matthew looked at her anxiously and nodded. She came across to the table and picked up the jug. As she leaned over, William reached down, slipped his hand under the hem of her tunic, and rapidly ran his fingers up her leg. His fingertips felt slender calves with soft hair, then the muscles behind her knee, and then the soft skin of the inside of her thigh. Then she jerked away, spun around, and swung the heavy wine jug at his head. William warded off the blow with his left hand and slapped her face with his right. He put all his force into the slap. His hand stung in a very satisfying way. Aliena screamed. Out of the corner of his eye, William saw Richard move. He had been hoping for that. He pushed Aliena aside forcefully, and she fell to the floor with a thud. Richard came at William like a deer charging the hunter. William dodged Richard's first wild blow, then punched him in the stomach. As the boy doubled over, William hit him several times in rapid succession about the eyes and nose. It was not as exciting as hitting Aliena, but it was gratifying enough, and within moments Richard's face was covered with blood. Suddenly Walter gave a warning cry and sprang to his feet, looking past William's shoulder. William spun round to see Matthew coming at him with a knife held high, ready to stab. William was taken by surprise. He had not expected bravery from the effeminate steward. Walter could not reach him in time to prevent the stroke. All William could do was to hold up both arms to protect himself, and for a terrible moment he thought he was going to be killed in his moment of triumph. A stronger attacker would have knocked William's arms aside, but Matthew was a slight figure, softened by indoor living, and the knife did not quite reach William's neck. He felt a sudden surge of relief, but he was not yet safe. Matthew lifted his arm for another blow. William took a step back and reached for his sword. Then Walter came around the table with a long, pointed dagger in his hand and stabbed Matthew in the back. An expression of terror came over Matthew's face. William saw the point of Walter's dagger emerge from Matthew's chest, tearing a slit in his tunic. Matthew's own knife fell from his hand and bounced on the floorboards. He tried to draw breath in a gasp, but a gurgling noise came from his throat and he seemed unable to breathe. He sagged. Blood came from his mouth, his eyes closed, and he fell. Walter withdrew the long dagger as the body sank to the floor. For a moment blood spurted from the wound, but almost immediately the flow slowed to a trickle. They all looked at the corpse on the floor. Walter, William, Aliena, and Richard. William was light-headed after his close brush with death. He felt as if he could do anything. He reached out and grabbed the neck of Aliena's tunic. The linen was soft and fine, very expensive. He gave a sharp jerk. The tunic ripped. He kept on pulling so that it tore all the way down the front. A strip a foot wide came away in his hand. Aliena screamed, then tried to pull the remnants of the garment to